Welcome to the podcast, folks. Happy Monday. Hope everybody's having a great start to the week, had a great weekend. It was rather rough in the Newman household. A couple of sick kids, a sick dad. Everybody's sick. Here we go. But we're on the right side of it today, and it's Monday. Let's get back to work. Let's get everything rocking and rolling, all right? Before we get there, let's get to Carly Clausen and the team over at Windsor Plywood, builders of the podcast studio table. For everything wood, these are the guys. Once again, when it comes to creative pieces of wood, just some slabs of wood that got some character, I always think of Windsor. They built the table back in 2019, if you can believe it, way back when we moved it into the first studio. It's come all the way here, and it is a centerpiece. I'll leave it at that. If you're looking interested in anything wood-related, head into to Windsor Plywood, take a look at what they got, do a little creeping on their Instagram page, creeping, and see what they're up to, because they got some pretty cool projects on the go. And whether we're talking mantles, decks, windows, doors, or sheds, these are the guys. Give them a call, 780-875-9663. Clay Smiley, team over at Profit River, they gave me a tour of the building here this past week, and it has come leaps and bounds ahead. I'm looking forward to maybe in the next couple of days. They're just getting flooring put in. They got all their custom cabinetry getting set up. And they're hoping for a January rollout date for when they're going to be live at the new location. They got the brand new sign. Now on my way home, I always see the Profit River sign right where the old Buckle sign used to be. That should resonate with a few people. Anyways, their new store is going to be pretty kick-ass by the looks of it. Of course, they specialize in importing firearms from the United States of America, and they pride themselves on making the process as easy as possible. Go check them out, profitriver.com, and see what they're up to. Major retailer of firearms, optics, and accessories serving all of Canada. Trophy Gallery, downtown Lloydminster. Christmas season is upon us. So if you're looking for awards, for your banquet, your Christmas gatherings, head into Trophy Gallery. They can get every business hooked up with something for appreciation for your staff. Or just go online, trophygallery.ca. You can check out exactly what I'm talking about. They can customize everything to your specifications, but I would hurry up. I wouldn't wait. You know, as we roll in closer and closer and closer, the turnaround times are going to be tougher and tougher for Clint and his team, but they always make you look sharp. They got everything, different sizes, different shapes, and all price ranges. Just stop in again. Downtown Lloydminster, they are Canada's award store, or visit them, trophygallery.ca. I want to shout out to Jen Gilbert. She was a part of the Health Foundation's fundraiser last week. She ran 65.42K and had a broken rib. Are you kidding me? This woman is a machine, all to benefit her community. And of course, her and the team for over 45 years, since 1976, the dedicated realtors, a Coldwell Banker, Cityside Realty, have served Lloydminster and the surrounding communities. They're always thinking community first, obviously. They give Star Power, providing their clients with 7-day-a-week access, because they know big life decisions are not made during office hours. That's Coldwell Banker, Cityside Realty, for everything real estate, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even with broken ribs. Give them a call, 780-875-3343. Mortgage broker Jill Fisher, her name says it all. She proudly serves the areas of Lloydminster, Bonnyville, Cold Lake, and Vermilion, and she's looking forward to working with you for all of your mortgage needs. If you don't have a clue and you're like, I don't know, we're renewing, I'm just going to take the best rate, or, you know, maybe we're going to buy a house and we don't know what the best rate is, blah, 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 don't listen to me. Give her a call, 780-872-2914, or stop in today, jfisher.ca. She'll get you set straight, all right? If you're looking for outdoor signage, the team over at Read and Write, they always make the podcast look sharp. Indoor wall quotes, my logo, the frosted glass, anything up their sleeve they can do for you. Give them a call, 306-825-5111. And Gartner Management is a Lloydminster-based company specializing in all types of rental properties to help meet your needs. And we got 1,800 square feet of open space here in the building. Whether you're looking for a single office or multiple, he can fit all your needs. Just give him a call, Mr. Wade Gartner, 780-808-5025. And if you stop in any of these businesses, make sure you let them know you heard about them from the podcast, right? Now, let's get on that T-Bar 1 Tale of the Tape. He is an internist, cardiologist, and epidemiologist. He maintains certification in internal medicine and cardiovascular diseases. He practices both internal medicine, including the management of common infectious diseases, as well as the cardiovascular complications of both the viral infection and the injuries developing after the COVID-19 vaccine in Dallas, Texas, USA. He has been a leader in the medical response to the COVID-19 disaster and has published the first synthesis of sequenced multi-drug treatment of ambulatory patients infected with SARS-CoV-2 in the American Journal of Medicine. He has 46 peer-reviewed publications on the infection and has commented extensively on the medical response to the COVID-19 crisis in The Hill and on Fox News Channel. I'm talking about Dr. Peter McCullough. So buckle up. Here we go.
This is Dr. Peter McCullough. Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast.
Welcome to the Sean Newman Podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Peter McCullough. Thanks for hopping back on, sir.
Sean, thanks for having me. It's great to be back on the show. As I met probably most of your listeners, but I'm an academic physician from Dallas, Texas, an American internist, cardiologist. I'm a trained epidemiologist. Spend about my time in clinical practice taking care of patients. I just came off a busy week of patient care. About the other half is spent in scholarship. I'm an author. I'm an editor. I'm a frequent news commentator, and it's really been a pleasure to come on your show. I think a leading podcast, really across a broad listenership.
Well, I tell you what, it's pretty cool to hear you say those words to me. That's awfully kind. But you know, I've been waiting to see if the guy I chase, the idol I chase, is ever going to have you on. And we were just talking about Joe Rogan, and you don't have to give any specific details, but you were mentioning that he's been after you to come on. And I think even that in itself is pretty cool.
You know, unlike with you and many of the celebrity media stars, I'm very respectful on texting and emailing. I try to keep it to a bare minimum, but I try to be responsive. And Joe Rogan did reach out to me. He said, I'd love to have you on the show. He reached out to me personally. In fact, I communicated with him personally all the way. I said, you know what? This is so important. I want to go to your studio, your man cave in Austin, Texas. So fortunately, I got a ride down. I was nervous. I was studying the facts, making sure I sent the producers the key graphics, the papers. I was like, I had my notes. I went down there and had a chance to meet Joe Rogan. He's actually a little shorter than I am. I was a little surprised. A good guy. And we went into his man cave. He just has his producer there. That's it. It's pretty modest. And we got into the data and we spent 3 hours and we soup to nuts on COVID-19. Now, I told him my story about how I felt really from a patriotic perspective, but just a humanistic perspective, I felt called to try to help these poor people suffering with COVID-19. I did the best I could with treatment and treatment protocols, the best I could publishing my ideas, my protocols, and then using outcomes data to show what works and what doesn't. And I did the best I could under sworn testimony at the U.S. Senate, multiple state senates. And now I spend a lot of time on media because now it's so important to disseminate. People need to get the information. It's one thing to do the academic work, but it's the next thing to do is actually translate it into clinical practice. COVID-19 is still a problem, and it needs leading media people, medically oriented media people like you, to get the message out.
Well, I didn't think anything could get you nervous. I mean, you come on here, you come on everywhere, you stand up in front of Senate, you rattle things off that I think most people go, holy man, how does your brain work? I'm surprised you get nervous about anything at this point, Peter.
Well, it was the longest interview I ever had, 3 hours of non-stop data review. And I was warned. I had talked to Chris Martinson and Brett Weinstein ahead of time. Brett's another famous podcaster. Brett said, whatever you do, McCullough, make sure you go to the bathroom ahead of time because you're not leaving the man cave. Could be 3 hours. I said, good Lord. I said, normally I'm a coffee drinker, but I better lay off here and get ready to rock and roll with joking. So it was a great experience, but I want to give a great shout out to other young podcasters, Mike Martinitz and Tommy Kerrigan. Certainly yourself, you're in there. Brett Weinstein. I've been on with so many great creative people. Tim and May Hindmarsh, they're Canadians that live in America. There's a lot of doctors who do medical podcasts. One of the more well-known ones was one of former mentors in Dallas, I'm sorry, actually, he was in trained in Dallas too, but he was a mentor to me in Detroit at William Beaumont, and that's Dr. Joel Kahn. He's been a podcaster. In so many ways, the Trusted News Initiative, which is the open censorship program that was announced December 10th, everybody knows about it. So people know they can't go to mainstream media and get fair, balanced information. So they are going to podcasts like crazy in order to find out information. Last year, I was purely in written format. I was a regular contributor to The Hill, where I published a series that's correctly painting the major deflections in the pandemic. And now this year, Malcolm Out Loud, I started my own radio show on America Out Loud, The McCullough Report. And it's doing well. You can tell me, you're a podcaster, but I was on this morning with Malcolm and he was watching the traffic on my Saturday morning broadcast. And then as a Sunday afternoon broadcast, but my broadcast this morning had 25,000 listeners. You know, I don't know, but you know, that's for a live feed. That's actually active listening when it's released. And then it goes to the McCullough Report, goes to the iHeart in Apple Pod, and the rest of the podcast servicing on Tuesday. But I make a report once a week to the United States and to the world. And I have a guest on, at least one guest. I've had more than one guest. And we try to give some update. I had a really fun one this week, Sean. I got to tell you, I had a gentleman named Ahmad Aden, and he's not a doctor. He's an engineer. And he reached out to me, you know, why? Sports fan. He's like you. He's a sports fan. And what he had done is he had done an analysis of how the vaccine mandates have influenced various people in sports. And he had categories of coaches, players by sports categories. And it was a lot of fun. I said, you know, give me your analysis. You worked pretty hard on it. And you know, his conclusion is the vaccine mandates are really influencing sports in a negative way. And he had a lot of working examples. But that's an example of America Out Loud Talk Radio. I started a new section a few months ago, and I was stimulated to do this by Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton had come to Dallas, you know, the famous guitarist. And he'd come to Dallas, and he texted me. Next time he called me and said he wanted to meet. And so my wife and I went to the hotel in Las Colinas, and Eric Clapton, he's a great guy. He invited us to one of his practice sessions. I gave a TED talk for his whole band. They hadn't been touring in 2 years. So I had a chance to meet them. My wife talked to Eric. Well, next thing you know, Eric was invited over to my house for dinner. So he came over to my house, Alice, and him and his personal physician who he wanted me to meet, a great guy, Dermot O'Flynn. And then his personal assistant came. And my wife made dinner, and we had a great time with Eric Clapton. We talked about how music basically was the sentiment of the time. And we talked about back in the 60s, there was protest music about the riots in the 1960s and what this sentiment is right now. So I started a music section on the McCullough Report, spurred by that discussion. And people each week, Sean, send me music that they think is relevant to the pandemic and the response. And this is a really popular section, including original music that people have done themselves, including ones that they see on, you know, various platforms. And I told like the whole song because I can't, I don't have the time, but I do, play a minute of the song. So that's another fun part of the podcast. So like you, I'm kind of learning a media person. I'm just a doctor, so I don't have any skills. I just do this on my laptop. And I try to do the best I can, but it is being mentioned and is thought to be helpful. One of the things that Malcolm Out Loud and I do, which is actually the most popular thing on the entire program, we did the 11th one today, is we do a question and answer session on COVID-19. So people type in their questions, then Malcolm organizes them, and then he asks me. And these, remember, America Out Loud Talk Radio was formed by Malcolm Out Loud. That's basically his stage name. And the signature program is called The Voice of a Nation. And boy, he's got the best radio voice ever. It's Voice of a Nation. Believe it or not, the questions and answers with Malcolm and McCullough have exceeded the listenership of The Voice of a Nation, which is amazing.
Well, I think first I would say to anyone listening who hasn't taken a listen or a peek at the McCullough Report. First off, you got to go. If you enjoy listening to yourself talk and your thoughts and your brain, I mean, what makes a great show is the guests And I mean, when you're a good guest on anyone's show, you having your own show where it's asking you questions about what's going on and it's pertinent, of course it's going to have success. That didn't surprise me in the least. And Chris Montoya was one of the guests you had, Professor Chris Montoya. And we had him on here because I enjoyed it so much. I was like, I got to get that in front of my group. Like that is fantastic. That's an interesting brain. And you, sir, have an interesting brain. That's why you're back again. That's why I keep harassing you. I always am impressed at how quickly you respond to my emails. I got to be honest. It's pretty cool. I wish the listeners could see the timetable on me sending, you responding. It's wild. I don't know how you have time.
Well, you know, I picked up this one and it was interesting. I had a desperate kind of news podcast from Cyprus and how desperate things have gone with the social policies, lockdowns, et cetera. And I could tell the person I was talking to was just distraught. And she was just trying to get basic questions answered. I was on with Chris McMaster from the UK, who does a wonderful medical podcast just ahead of you. So I've been kind of jockeying them day. And, you know, I think it is wonderful. You're right. It's really personalities that are involved. And it's also the journalism that each podcast different has a different journalistic style. And I usually let them just kind of take over. But I have to tell you, we've shared some guests and I agree. Chris Montoya, and when he came on, I thought he was so fascinating. He actually had to get approval from his university to come on. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, what is he going to say? And he came on and I agree with you. He was so interesting as a professor in the, you know, basically the neuropsychological sciences that I said, wow, I want to go to school. I want to be in college again and learn from you. One of the things that's happened in the pandemic is we spend so much time online with each other now. I have learned. So for instance, John Campbell from the UK, what a wonderful teacher. He sits down, he explains what these drugs are. He uses a almost like a whiteboard, but it's like a magnifier over his desk and he's drawing it out and he's just so evidence. I was on today with Chris Martinson. Chris Martinson is a former faculty at Duke. And I told Chris the same thing. I said, Chris, you're one of the best teachers that's out there. So we learned from all of them. But I have to tell you, there is one recent video that has really, really impressed me. And I have to tell you about it. It's by Matthias Desmet. And boy, if you could get him on, I've recently had on the McCullough Report following up Dr. Mark McDonald. Desmet is a professor of clinical psychology at the University of Ghent in Belgium. McDonald is a psychiatrist, an MD psychiatrist in LA. McDonald has come out with a book called The United States of Fear, How We Fell into a Mass Psychosis. And Desmet, Matthias gave the credit. Desmet, basically, his whole life has been working on this research idea of mass psychosis. And, you know, it's been observed that with religious cults, how they can get into a mass psychosis and there'll be a mass suicide. And mass psychosis was basically describing what happened in Nazi Germany, where pretty normal, well-intentioned people ended up doing horrific things on both sides of the ledger, including mass psychosis, where people walked into gas chambers and things of this nature and, you know, gave up their children in eugenic programs. So this mass psychosis has been interesting. And what Desmet said, he's disappointed that he didn't recognize it soon enough. So Sean, what happened is he said, listen, I'm a professor in this and I didn't realize what was going on. He says, we're in a mass psychosis. And so the interesting thing is the criteria for a mass psychosis are four things. Everyone can remember this. First, we must have a period of isolation. Okay, we've got that. Second is we must have enjoyable things withdrawn from us. That's happened. Number three, we must have constant free-floating anxiety. All the time. We've got that. And he says the fourth thing, that's the capper. We must have a single solution offered by an entity of authority. Bingo. We've got that. The vaccines. He said we're in a mass psychosis. And it's interesting. He says there's no limit to the absurdity of the solution. There's no limit. And that's what we're seeing right now with the vaccines. There's no limit to the absurdity of vaccines, who's getting vaccines, vaccinating people who don't need it, you know, on and on and on, vaccinating even in the wake of adverse safety data and waning efficacy. And so I think the whole learning of mass psychosis in the last couple of years, Matthias Desmet, and now this book by Mark McDonald, United States of Fear, they're very, very good to look at. There's a video that was put out with wonderful graphics by Dr. Robert Malone, who was one of the early developers of the vaccines. It's really come out hard now on bioethics. That's worth looking at as well.
I think all Canadians are waiting to see what Americans do. I mean, because you give me the impression that, you know, yeah, we all know it's mass psychosis and we're going to walk out of this thing. And yet, as it stands in Canada, you have the vax pass going. You can't fly on federal transportation. You can't fly out of your country. You can't go into pretty much every store under the planet. You can't go buy yourself a case of beer if you want to, if you don't have the vax pass. And so we sit right now in different worlds, in my opinion. I watch what the Americans are doing, and I, you know, all the different things going on in the courts and some big wins for not implementing mandatory vaccinations on the American side. But on the Canadian side, it feels completely different. I was curious, what do you think while you're sitting down there looking up at the north here?
Americans have always galvanized around one thing. You know, we're a fractious society. We're always 51 to 49% on every vote we ever do. I mean, Americans are fractious, but we unify on one thing, Sean, and that's freedom. And we smell a loss of freedom in the United States. And boy, talk about people coming out freedom. There are now public symposiums, you know, myself and others with just grassroots organizations. We're going into cities, just giving an update on COVID-19, like I've done on your shows in the past, just evidence-based, just going over the manuscripts. People are taking half a day or day off of work. We do a lawmaker program, then a doctor's program. We move into a public program. The tickets are sold out. You know, and there's a nice, people pay a modest fee to hotel room and hors d'oeuvres. They want pictures, and then they want the data, and they want a panel discussion. So we bring doctors up, and we just answer questions, settle people down. It's really an American reawakening. I've done programs in Lincoln, Nebraska. And every time we do a program, by the way, we change policy. So I went into Lincoln, Nebraska, home of the Nebraska Cornhuskers. And I gave a program. I gave a lecture. Dr. Stephen Petty gave a lecture on masks. He's the world's expert on masks. And then we had an attorney give a lecture on civil rights. And within 48 hours, the attorney general wrote a brief that basically was over a 40-page brief. I'm heavily cited in it. And it basically told the medical board, don't you dare touch these doctors for using hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. Let them treat COVID-19 as they see appropriate. And it was like, wow, I just can't believe he did that. I mean, it was so impressive within 48 hours. I went up to Independence, Kansas. I had just been up there after Dr. Brian Artis, another doctor on our team, who's a real expert on inpatient care and the data there, particularly Desivir. We went into Independence, Kansas, lawmaker program, went into a big public program. Within 48 hours, the medical director of Kansas was fired, and they had sweeping orders came in to get rid of all the mandates for vaccines across Kansas. And then I've done similar programs in Jackson, Mississippi, in Huntsville, Alabama, and Bartlesville, Oklahoma, in multiple places, in San Diego most recently. And I think Bill Capper is that there was so much activity going in the courts. People felt that these mandates were a giant overreach. You know, the vaccines are simply not working that well. And there's great concerns over safety. And so it ultimately came down to there was a few states that had basically listened, you know, the states' rights, Trump, the president of the United States' ability to issue a vaccine mandate. Because don't forget, mandates are not law. So just because somebody wants a mandate, they can announce it by press release. That doesn't have any authority. Some states said, no, we're not going to do it. So what happened was I was asked as an expert to submit a report on vaccine safety and efficacy as an expert to the case in Louisiana in the Sixth Circuit Court, and the Judge Dowdy presided. And he ultimately wrote his decision. It was a 34-page decision. saying he relied on two doctors, Dr. McCullough, myself, and Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, and his opinion to overturn the Biden CMS mandates for the country. And so there was a giant cheer of applause for when the Biden mandates were struck down. And people basically, right after that, there was a wave of executive orders. We had one in Texas within a day that was written by Governor Greg Abbott that said no vaccine mandate by any organization in Texas. And I tell you, that was mute to our ears. People are celebrating. I've got a copy of that letter. Sean, after we're done, I have to do some patient exemptions for vaccination. And I'm going to attach the governor's letter to the exemptions, basically telling the employers, you can't do this. You can't mandate a vaccine that's still in research. It's not sufficiently effective. You can't mandate it against someone's will.
Can you send that to Canada as well? Because we're in a strange world where tons of people are being mandated they get the vaccine, Peter. Like, this is where I come back to. We're living in different worlds right now.
Listen, I'm very, very familiar with this, Sean. My wife is, as you know, she's a Torontonian. She's a Canadian. She's a dual Canadian citizen. You know, she has very elderly parents. They've been in lockdown for 2 years, age 88 and 98. My father-in-law has been in the hospital several times, been sick. He's gone through multiple COVID rule-outs. He's been away from his wife for months. All the kids live in the United States, Sean. We can't get in there. So basically what happened is, as part of the Canadian vaccine program, they're elderly. They did get fully vaccinated, my wife's parents. And then my wife's sister here in Florida, she did have to take the vaccine in order to cross the border. And she crossed the border, and we basically retrieved my parents out of Canada and flew them to Dallas-Fort Worth. And when I picked them up at the airport, I picked up two people who had been in prison for 2 years. They lost so much weight, and it was just awful. I loaded them in my pickup truck. You know, down here in Texas, Sean, we drive pickup trucks almost exclusively. Loaded them in my big Texas Cadillac and Dodge Ram. Took them home, and thank the Lord, you know, we're starting to feed them, get them back. And honestly, we just, you know, they're not going to go back. There's nothing we can do. Canada is becoming now, it's enough of this basically totalitarianism falls into place. I'm not sure how you make it. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to break it before we get to the Canadian point or point, the EU, Cyprus, Australia, South Africa. So you're right. Look at America and use anything we're doing to your advantage to see if we can't turn things around in Canada. I'm deeply worried. You know, we rely on U.S.-Canadian trade. Many of us have families that straddle the borders. And obviously our whole, you know, our NHL straddles the border, and so does the Major League Baseball. I mean, even sports. I know you're a big sports fan. You know, we straddle this important border. We're kind of the world's greatest neighbors, right? United States and Canada. It's almost as if we're bordering on the Soviet Union right now, Sean.
Yeah, it's strange times. I mean, I don't mean to paint the picture where sitting in Canada, you're living in the gulag. You're not. It's still, but at the same time, it's odd times here, and they continue to stay odd. I was hoping I could bug you about Omicron. What have your research told you about the latest variant they're pushing on all news networks and the oncoming onslaught of it, that it's more transmissible, blah, blah, blah. What's your thoughts there, Peter?
I'd point your listeners to Brownstone Institute. If you want to go to a website and really learn a lot about COVID, Brownstone's doing a great job. And one of their lead contributors is Dr. Paul Alexander from McMaster, former professor at McMaster in Canada. He's a great guy to have on. Paul's a personal friend. He's doing a great job. In the very first piece I saw on Omicron, he had a picture of Optimus. It was so cute because it's not a transformer. It's actually the name of the latest. Paul's got a 9-year-old boy, and I'm sure the first thing he thought about when he heard Omicron, he thought it was the next transformer in the movie series. But it's not a transformer. It is a variant. It was described on the border of Botswana. A couple of travelers, fully vaccinated, no symptoms, basically tested positive. It had an interesting PCR profile. The PCR uses primers. It uses four primers that is little strands of code for four different proteins. One is the RNA-dependent polymerase, the spike protein, the envelope protein, and the nucleocapsid, those four. And it was a pattern where there was what's called S gene dropout. So the spike code had dropped out. I say, boy, that's unusual, because you know, those primers are pretty steady in this spike protein code. And what was learned, Sean? Yeah, it must be the most dysmorphic or misshapen spike protein so far, because it has 30 mutations in the spike protein. Spike protein, by the way, has 1,200 amino acids. And typically you change one base pair, it's a pretty big change. So 30 mutations in the spike protein, Sean, 10 in the receptor binding domain, which is the tip of S1. And of those, there are three deletions, one insertion. You hardly ever see an insertion, Sean. So an insertion. And then once the code is figured out pretty quickly, we had coming out of the Fantini in Marseille, France. And I wanted to update your listeners on this, where by modeling, so we don't know this to be the case yet, infectivity studies are still underway. But to give you an idea, the Wuhan wild type had a transmissibility index by this method of 2.16. The Delta virus, which is the 99% of what we had, has a transmissibility index of 10.67. Omicron came in 3.9. So this is the first time that we had a mutation where there was a step down transmissibility from, like, again, this will all have to be confirmed. And so I was called on NLT last week to give my impressions of Omicron. I told the Americans that I thought it was basically an evolutionary mistake. It must have been. It's, the viruses don't mutate and become less transmissible. It's going to go too far. It had already spread to other parts of the world, but it's pretty clear it's not taking off like wildfire. And I think it'll be similar to Lambda and similar to Epsilon. Lambda came out of Peru. Epsilon came out of California, where it will find an ecological niche in susceptible individuals. But it won't replace Delta. Delta is 99% of what we have. It's more transmissible. And fortunately with Omicron, maybe it would be good if it takes over, because it is so far described as being mild, meaning no pulmonary symptoms, just some constitutional symptoms, no deaths. And we'll have to follow this now. It always depends who gets early treatment. We can never say, oh, the strain is the factor in terms of death. Is always who receives early treatment. But so far, we're not getting any bad signs at all on Omicron. I think what people were really astounded with is how rapidly the vaccine manufacturers jumped in, literally within 24 hours, and said, oh, we've got a vaccine for that. We're adjusting our vaccines. One company said, oh, we've been working on this for a while. It's like, wait a minute, you've been working on it? I thought it just came out. How did you start working on this? So, world said, gosh, those responses seem contrived. They didn't seem to be in line with the pathogenicity of the virus. So we'll have to see how things play out, but that'd be up in Omicron.
Yeah, I was curious, you bring up Pfizer. Well, you didn't bring up Pfizer, but you bring up the the different pharmaceutical companies. I follow the New York Times, and they've been talking about Merck and Pfizer's new drugs coming out, and that they're going to be game changers and everything like that. And I always chuckle, because it's almost like early treatment up until this point hasn't been anything that's ever been talked about. But as we both know, there's been more than one drug that's been mentioned in early treatment, and how early treatment can save a lot of lives. What's your thoughts on all the new drugs coming out from Merck and Pfizer specifically?
Early treatment is pretty mature at this point in time. We use what's called sequence multi-drug therapy for COVID-19. There's four organizations that endorse early treatment. The first one was Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. Then came the Frontline Critical Care Consortium, American Frontline Doctors, now Truth for Health Foundation. So they're very well established. It takes about 4 to 6 drugs used in combination. In the United States, we're fortunate. We have monoclonal antibodies, so they're a big part of the program now. And as we had mentioned, podcaster Joe Rogan got what's called sequence multi-drug therapy. I told Joe Rogan, got the McCullough protocol. It's actually copyrighted now. I said, you basically got what I invented, Joe. I think he was stunned to learn that, really this sequence of drugs that involve nutraceuticals, monoclonal antibodies, and then drugs in combination. It's my practice pattern that if we use the monoclonal antibodies. We skip hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin. I go right into the steroids and anticoagulants. But the bottom line is, you know, we can use multiple drugs to get people through the illness. This update for Canadian audiences on early treatment, Sean, has to do with the idea of viral nasal and oral washes. This is really 9 studies, including high quality clinical trials, over 2,000 patients. It turns out that if you wash the nose and mouth with very dilute povidone iodine, very dilute hydrogen peroxide with some Lugol's iodine, that one can dramatically decrease the risk of acquiring the infection. So it's preventive, particularly if you go out in a crowded wedding party, what have you, come home, you can pick up the virus and it'll take 3 days for it to multiply and become an ill in the nose. And you can zap it with forms of these solutions. Either, you know, it has to be a pretty generous spray up in the nose, sniff it back, and then spit it out. But povidone iodine's the king. And the key is it's a 10% betadine solution that you buy at the Canadian pharmacies or on Amazon. 2 teaspoons, 6 ounces of water. Go ahead and get a bulb syringe or a spray bottle, spray it up the nose, snort it back, spit it out, go with it, save the rest for later on. You can use that about, you know, once or twice a day prevention. Now, in active treatment, we actually go every 4 hours on this now because we know that the Delta variant, Sean, is multiplying so rapidly and the nose is filling up with the virus. You basically zap the virus down and reduce the kind of viral loading in the body with this approach. A randomized trial by Chowdhury and colleagues, 606 people, randomized 303 in each group. It was clear that they basically knocked down the PCRs within a day or two of this, doing nothing where the virus is still raging through this period of time. And they dramatically reduced the risk of hospitalization death with that approach alone at about 75%. So what I'm telling you is with oral and nasal viral therapy, plus the over-the-counter things available in Canada, which would be zinc 50 milligrams, vitamin 3, 5,000 international units. We increased that now to 20,000 units in active treatment. Vitamin C, 3,000 milligrams. Quercetin at 500 milligrams twice a day. And then we add an over-the-counter drug called famotidine or Pepcid, which is an antihistamine drug that actually blocks viral replication through the TMPRSS2 receptor at 80 milligrams a day. That kind of shoebox that I just described, Sean, that's home treatment base for Canadians that they can buy, they can keep in their home. No doctor is needed. No government's going to stop you. That's the best defense. So what I tell my patients now, I tell every patient, Sean, on days you don't leave the house, you don't need to worry. But days you go out to the store or go out to church, come back, do the oral nasal washes and get yourself taken care of. It's not a hand infection. There's been an incredible preoccupation with hand sanitizer, Sean. It's not even spread by the hands. People keep putting hand sanitizer on like they're doing something. Do you know there were movie clips of news clips of people doing, you know, spraying stadium seats. There's even one in Europe where they were spraying the sidewalk like it was transmitted off the sidewalk. It's a respiratory virus, Sean. It's transmitted in the air. You don't get it from a hockey stadium seat. You get it in the air. I think the biggest risk are closed spaces like public restrooms, closed conference rooms. It takes about 3 hours of close contact before you transmit the virus. 85% of the transmission occurs in the home.
Yeah, that's a lot of information, Pete. You have a way of just rattling it off and a guy trying to just hold on for dear life, so to speak, to everything that comes out of your brain. The in-the-home thing is interesting to me because, we got Christmas coming up and we just had the media talking about you best be careful who you let in your house at Christmas and, you know, careful of vaccination status and that type of thing. What's your thoughts on Christmas coming up?
Well, you know, I can tell you they don't celebrate Christmas there, but I've been very impressed with Bangladesh. It was Dr. Chowdhury in his randomized trial done in Bangladesh where he innovated on the oral nasal povidone iodine approach for prevention and treatment. Now, analysis by Chopra and colleagues strongly supports that. And Bangladesh, 150 million people, they're down to near zero COVID. If they were to have Christmas, they'd be in good shape. I think what people need to know for Christmas is that pay attention to symptoms. Anybody with symptoms, stay at home. Don't go visit grandmother if you've got a runny nose or a cough. You know, previously we had a cold, we'd go out and see people. We don't do that anymore. So pay attention to symptoms. If someone has no symptoms, they can't transmit it. So it doesn't make a difference if you took the vaccine or not. If you don't have any symptoms, you're not going to transmit the virus. And so we're in live programs. I mentioned, you know, 500 to 5,000 people. I'll be in a big audience in a hotel ballroom. I'll stop for a minute and just listen. I'll say, listen, we got 1,000 people in the room. I don't hear anybody coughing. Nobody's sneezing. There's no old man in the back with a big honking handkerchief blowing his nose. You know, none of that's happening anymore, Sean, because people are paying attention to symptoms. So Canadians can visit each other at Christmas, provided one has symptoms. Whether or not someone taken the vaccine is irrelevant. And here's for the following reasons. We now know the vaccines had pretty good coverage against alpha, beta, and gamma variants in the original Wuhan spike protein, but everything fell off the cliff in September. And in a paper by Cohn and colleagues from the VA, we saw the coverage of Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson fall off a cliff. The same thing was shown by a paper by Nordstrom and colleagues from Sweden, fell off a cliff for the following reasons. Because we basically had the fully shading in the Delta variant, which has achieved antigenic escape from the vaccine. So, you know, vaccines don't cover Delta very well. And the second thing that we saw was that the expiration date had occurred. We had 6 months. The majority of people in the United States took the vaccine December, January, February, March. And we got to 6 months on the vaccines, the coverage failed. Now, of all the analyses I've seen, the best vaccine in terms of preventing COVID is actually Moderna. Moderna is the winner. It's 100 micrograms of messenger RNA. Pfizer is just 30 micrograms, and Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca are adenoviral particles. But Moderna is the winner. It's the strongest vaccine. And what we know there is that Moderna, the coverage, sufficient coverage is only 6 months. And then we did have studies weigh in on efficacy. And people say, well, Dr. McCullough, you're really hard on the vaccines. Did the vaccines actually ever do anything? Well, in a paper by Nordstrom and colleagues, just looking at the binary outcome of COVID-19 respiratory illness, there was about 90% vaccine efficacy. That wasn't a good matched pair analysis, but it fell off to about 70 with Moderna, and it fell off to, unfortunately, fell off to, you know, below 30% with Pfizer at 6 months, but it was better. And then in terms of hospitalization, we had data from SELF and from 1040 on hospitalization. The 1040 paper is worth mentioning. That's the first author. It's in JAMA, where it was clear for hospitalization, it looked like 85% protection against hospitalization. But once we looked at hospitalized patients, because don't bet people who test positive in the hospital are labeled as COVID if they don't have it. And so we differentially test patients who have not been vaccinated compared to vaccinated. Numbers are stilted. But having said that, we looked at progression of those who did it really have COVID. Did they progress in the hospital? There was over a 50% protection with the vaccines with that number. But once we got down to mortality, which is really matters, it turns out mortality for vaccinated or unvaccinated now is less than 10%. It was a little bit better for the unvaccinated. It wasn't that much. I mean, a little bit better for the vaccinated compared to unvaccinated, but it wasn't much. So the point is the vaccines were doing something. They ran out of efficacy in September, by and large. It's a modest protection against death, proper protection against hospitalization. So it's not as if the vaccines don't do anything, but I think the vaccines came at a great cost in terms of safety.
Yeah, well, I mean, here as we sit right now, it's been opened up to 5 to 11-year-olds. So now you have the young children being vaccinated. That's been a big push. Here in the last couple weeks, I think it's up to 40,000 Saskatchewan kids have been vaccinated with their first dose, their first round. And I don't know, what do you want to speak on kids being vaccinated? I mean, the biggest thing, I take this from the New York Times. I'll give you a breather here. The New York Times on December 3rd said the hospitalization rate is similar to that of the typical flu. For children vaccinated or not, the risks are even smaller. I mean, that's in one of the leading papers who's been pushing get vaccinated, and that's what they say.
It's not very compelling. You know, we had the data ages 12 to 17. The author was Frank and colleagues, New England Journal of Medicine. Then we had the paper by Walther and colleagues ages 5 to 11. You know, in total, those two papers combined, there was about 4,500 kids in randomized trials. And, you know, all this effort on vaccination versus placebo, it basically prevented about 24 cases of the sniffles. That was it. No severe infections, no spread mentioned, nothing else. The vaccines were just very unimpressive. I mean, the kids get 4 to 8 colds a year. It looks like the vaccines had no real clinical impact. Now, about a third of the kids got pretty sick with the vaccines. They got fever, body aches, muscle aches. But I tell you, the registrational trial is not impressive at all in terms of clinical benefit. And then we have the emerging data from Bruce Patterson and now a first author, Banzel, showing that the spike protein after that's generated vaccination, Sean, it stays in the human body for about over a year. So these poor kids who are taking the vaccine, that spike protein is in their body for a year before they get it out. I mean, no wonder people feel sick, you know, afterwards. And I asked Patterson on the McCullough report, I said, is there ever an example where a piece of an organism stays in the body for over a year after the infection? He goes, there is. He said, Lyme disease. Very interesting. Lyme, there is a post-Lyme syndrome because remnants of the organism Borrelia burgdorferi stay in the human body. So I thought that was an interesting comment. But now we know the spike protein is loaded in the kid's body. Ages 12 to 17 in the United States is Pfizer. It's still at the adult dose, 30 micrograms per messenger RNA. And the messenger RNA directs a mosaic of cells to produce the spike protein. And that's what's dangerous to the body. And then in children age 5 to 11, they drop down the dose to 10 micrograms. But I tell you, the mechanism of action is dangerous. The kids get no clinical benefit from this. Today, we heard an announcement now for boosters in the United States, age 12 to 7. Again, it wasn't compelling to begin with. And we have the looming, very strong wording on myocarditis in individuals. And probably myocarditis is the most dreaded of all the complications we are learning about with COVID-19 vaccines in children.
Well, I appreciate you coming. With a few minutes left, I see we got about 10, 15 minutes left, something like that. I want to switch in. I've been switching a couple things here, Peter, as we've gone along. I want to give the little segment at the end over to the fans, so to speak, because obviously they're ones that make, without them, I don't know where I'd be. They just keep pushing this thing along. So I want to give them a little more control. So here is the fans' final questions brought to you by Crudemaster. shout out to Heath and Tracy McDonald, who've been supporters of the podcast since the very beginning. And I'll say Heath in particular, Peter, went in the hospital because of COVID. Talked with him a couple days ago, and he talked about it pretty openly. They told him he was within hours of probably not being there anymore. And got life-saving treatment from the fine folks here. So my next question is, well, you getting the vaccine? Well, no. Why the hell would I do that? All right. Well, just curious, right? Like, here's a guy who's seen the inside of the beast. He had some other thoughts on what we're all seeing right now with vaccinations waning, failing, and tons of people getting sick. But regardless, he is one of the guys who's continued to support this. And I bet you could talk an awful lot about support, as you've been very vocal since the very beginning, and there must have been a few different dark times in that time for you, Peter, but he's been one of the guys who stood behind me from the very beginning, and I appreciate that.
Well, that's great to hear. It's great to hear. Hospitalization is a tremendous story. It's happened in my family, in my circles. I haven't saved all the patients. Believe me, I respect that as a very, very serious illness, and it is a brush of death, and everyone should take it seriously. But thankfully, the immunity now is robust, complete. It is durable. We're not seeing any signs of infection, even with Omicron. It's not going to happen. It's one and done. That recent CDC was pressed on this through a legal freedom of information request, and CDC admitted they've never seen a case of natural immunity failure, of someone who failed natural immunity and spread it to anyone. CDC has 41,000 cases plus of full vaccine failure, including hospitalization and death. So the vaccines are failing in large, but not a single failure of natural immunity.
Well, here's what a listener from Saskatoon wanted to know from you. And I've heard and even read a few different articles on this. It's hard for me to get my brain around, but he's talking about the global blood supply. If he gets in an accident, Does he have to worry about getting, if he doesn't want to, have blood with, I can't believe I'm saying this, but with a vaccine in it? He's worried about, like, could he have same side effects from blood that's got the COVID vaccines in it?
You know, this spring, a group of pathologists that I was in the same circle with wrote the American College of Blood Banking, the American Red Cross, and Carter Blood Center, a variety of donation organizations, and expressed the current concern that the blood supply could be spiked because someone who donates blood, they're not restricted in terms of what they've taken the vaccine. They know that within 4 weeks of taking the vaccine, the spike protein freely circulatory. We know within the probably the first day or two, there are is circulating lipid nanoparticles. It may not longer than that. But it's disturbing to think that the spike protein, which we know is dangerous and some are is lethal, is actually now into donated blood. And we got responses back from the organization saying, listen, we understand your concern, we're looking at it. We didn't hear anything more beyond that. There is conjecture, though, there's been so many people who've donated blood that for the pooled plasma products, there's enough collective antibodies out there to just neutralize whatever spike protein is there, because since so many people have had the infection or have taken the vaccine, red blood cells, you know, that are washed, they're not going to have much in terms of spike protein there. So it turns out it may be hopefully a non-issue just because of the large prevalence of neutralizing antibodies.
Okay. Von Dubs wanted to know, he's a fellow podcaster, your thoughts on aspiration, the theory of when injecting the vaccine, not pulling back on the syringe, so to speak, to see if it's in muscle or in a blood vessel. What's your thoughts on that, and whether that would cause some of the vaccine to migrate, you know, with Byron Bridle up here in Canada bringing a lot of the research on it migrating to the blood-brain barrier and the ovaries and a bunch of things like that. He was just curious about aspiration and your thoughts on that, if that could have been a problem or an issue.
The concept is you can keep the vaccine in the arm. If we could just keep it in the arm and not have it distribute throughout the body, maybe we could reduce side effects. It's not a bad thought, John. What we know is that typically, you know, within an hour, we can find measurable production of spike protein. It may not be emanating from the deltoid muscle. And aspirating, when you put in the needle to pull back, aspirating to make sure we're not in an artery or vein is always good practice. So it should be done anyway. But the last thing we want to do is hit a vein or an artery and just blast the lipid nanoparticles throughout the body. I hope that's not happening. I hope everyone is aspirating. If you're going to take a vein, ask them to do that. You know, I have seen one side effect in my practice, though, which I had never previously thought about. Remember, the spike protein basically is injurious to nerves. That's what causes the neuropathies, the loss of taste and smell. The spike protein, in a sense, fries the olfactory nerve, the auditory nerve, and causes tinnitus, whatever. I saw a patient who had taken the vaccine and must have hit the radial nerve, which goes right down to it. And she basically has no sensation in her radial nerve now. The vaccine has kind of fried one of the major nerves to the arm. So we're seeing all kinds of vaccine-induced injuries. We have over 19,000 deaths after the vaccines in this program. About half of those are domestic. 31,000 people permanently disabled, 4 million people making emergency visits, and over 1 million injuries. That's with 200 million people taking the vaccine. So you may, that's a small number because 200 million, but you know, we vaccinate 278 million every year with other vaccines, and we only get, you know, a tiny fraction, maybe 150 deaths with all of that. So these numbers are far too high. They're unacceptably high. The vaccines need to be paused for safety.
Mm. That leads me to the final question. You know, up here in Canada, you can tell the different where we're at country to country, right? I just feel from you, you know, like the big wins coming out in the court, it feels like maybe COVID is winding down. Like maybe even the vaccine mandate, like go get it. You don't want to go get it. Educate yourself, carry on with life. Let's go. Where here in Canada, it feels like it's going to be a slower process than that, especially with the 5 to 11-year-olds currently getting it. And you can just feel like there's just this feeling of like, just go get it. Just go get it. And there's a lot of people that are feeling that pressure. And that's what leads me up to the last question. It was about Novavax. We talked about this very, very early on, Peter. Maybe our first interview, we sat down and you mentioned maybe Novavax will be the way out of this. Do you still think about Novavax at all? Do you still watch that? And what's your thoughts?
I do. Novavax, 800 person company in the United States, their product is a purified spike protein. It's actually produced in a genetic model using moths, believe it or not. They're that's the mechanism by which the spike protein is produced. It's put into a matrix, and they've chosen the 5 microdose as opposed to the 25 microgram dose. It clearly appeared to be immunogenic. The registrational trials, Sean, were great. In June, 90% protection against COVID-19. Now, granted, it's a legacy variant, but looked very good. Very sore arm. The arm is more sore than Pfizer and Moderna, but appeared to be free of systemic effects, which really is what matters. I'm still very high on vax. There was some delays in manufacturing, and it looks like now ready to go. They're going to emerge in some non-US markets. I don't know if they're going to hit it or not, but I still remain very high on Novavax. Looking at the range of choices that I see right now, I would choose Novavax over the genetic vaccines.
Well, and she just had a couple other quick questions on it. Do you think it'll be recognized by countries to travel with? Like, will it be one of those ones where it's like, oh, you've got Novavax, you can't get in? Or because early on, we had the problem of we did mix and match. And then there was people with mix and match, and they couldn't go to certain places because of that. They didn't recognize it. So that's why, you know, Novavax is, you know, is that going to be something that's going to have any issues such as that?
No, I don't think it will. I think it'll be fully recognized.
Well, then her final one was the boosters. Boosters is a big thing that's being pushed right now. Everybody go get your booster. And I know where you stand on the vaccines, but I'm curious, do you think with Novavax, if they were to get it out, I mean, this is such a hypothetical, do you think they'd need boosters with it as well?
No, I don't know. I'm hoping the spike protein with Novavax would be more immunogenic, maybe give a more diverse array of epitopes. One of the things with Pfizer, Moderna, J&J is that they give a very high antibody rise, but it's only very narrow against a few targets on the spike protein. You know, with the natural infection, we have, you know, basically antibodies against 27 proteins. The vaccine is just one protein. The vaccine is just too thin and too monolithic as a protection program. It'd be hopeful that Novavax would be more diverse in terms of its antibodies. And, you know, my personal view is that probably the only people who really need a vaccine, if a vaccine was safe and effective, would be nursing home residents, nursing home workers, maybe home daycare workers. So Novavax could be positioned as kind of the universal booster is what I think is going to happen. And, you know, if other countries pick it up and we learn more about it, terrific. I'm personally, I've taken all the vaccines. I'm not anti-vax, Sean. I'm a cardiologist. I take hepatitis B vaccine at periodic intervals when my titers go down and the influenza vaccine. I went to India. I took extra vaccines. I have no problem with vaccines. It's just that I want the products to be safe for Canadians and Americans. I don't want to hear about any more deaths after people taking the vaccines. No more heart inflammation. Myocarditis is unacceptable as a complication. Blood clots in the brain are unacceptable.
How about
complications? That's just over the line. That's over the line. It's like zero. No, it's like, no, not even a single case. I don't want to hear about that.
Well, that's straight from Lisa McDougall. I was searching for her name. I didn't write it down. So Lisa McDougall is the one who came with those questions. I got one final question then for you, Peter, before I let you go. And I know we're short on time, but I've been wondering this. I know a bunch of guys who've gotten Bell's palsy from their first shot. Then they go to the pharmacist, take a few things and they're fine. What's your thoughts on that? Like, is that a standard complication of a vaccine getting Bell's palsy? Because it's almost kind of like, oh yeah, it's totally fine. That's a normal thing.
You know, it came up in the registrational trials. I think it was a little bit more expected with Pfizer and Moderna. We actually saw, you know, people ostensibly healthy getting Bell's palsy, which is sometimes it's temporary. And now seeing thousands of cases of Bell's palsy with the COVID-19 vaccines. I don't know if it's above the background rate or not. I just know it's very uncomfortable. The eye is dry. It doesn't close. And so the eye dryness is really, there's almost an episcleritis in the mouth, but doesn't close, and it's constant.
Go back, the vaccines you've administered and been around and had clients and patients and everything else. Have you ever seen where it's just like, oh yeah, they had Bell's palsy, not a big deal. Take three pills and you carry on with life. Was that ever anything with any other?
No, it's never normalized. No one wants Bell's palsy. There's a professor in my work group at work. He developed it. It was awful. I mean, it really, really messed up his life. It disfigures the face. It's so uncomfortable for the nose. Now you're right. Sometimes of Bell's palsy, sometimes there's a combination of steroids and valacyclovir. Sometimes it's used to see if we can't reverse it. But sadly, these thousands of cases of Bell's palsy, some of them are going to be permanent. The faces are permanently disfigured. It'll never be the same again. I've had patients in my practice, and it's hard for me to estimate, but it's 50-50. It's just permanent Bell's palsy, and every patient regrets it. It changes the course of their life.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and doing this again. It's always a pleasure having you. Enjoy your brain thoroughly, just the way it works and processes information, and wish you the best here in 2022 coming up here pretty darn quick. And I assume we'll try and wrangle you back in for another one in the new year at some point. But thanks again, Peter. Always great to have you on.
Okay. Thanks for having me. I really worry about you. You know, the Canadians can't get beer to watch their hockey up there if they take the vaccine. It's going to really influence them, because I know you can only buy beer at your Canadian beer stores, right? You can't even go to a grocery store and get beer. So, rough times up there.
We're all brewing it ourselves.
Okay, very good.
Awesome. Talk to you later. Hey guys, thanks for hopping in today. I hope you enjoyed it. I really do appreciate you stopping in, giving me some of your hard-earned time to sit down with one of my guests and hear one of my conversations. If you haven't subscribed or hit the like button, please do it. It does help. Leave a review. I always enjoy seeing what your thoughts are. If you want to contact me personally, text line's always open. I enjoy hearing from every listener and their thoughts as we continue along this path. And finally, if you want to support the podcast, make sure to check out my Patreon account in the show notes. Now, get out there, kick some ass, and we'll catch up to you Wednesday.